right, so first of all, are there leftover matters from the last class that anyone would like to raise issues with? We didn't get through all the material that was laid out in the outline, but we'll be revisiting those themes in any case. Any issues at all? As I walked in today, Chris asked me a question. He said that he had heard that there was a lively debate in the Haven Center lecture between me and the visitor, Sujata Patel, yesterday. He wanted to know what it was all about. It is of at least some indirect relevance to the class, so I thought I could give you a two-minute version of what was in play there. She's giving a second lecture today and then a seminar tomorrow. Her style of work and her general arguments are certainly not exactly my cup of tea, but it's nevertheless worthwhile engaging it. It is a very common and widespread theoretical position, and I think a genuine one. Sometimes you think there's a lot of posturing in this stuff. So basically what was in play was the question of whether, she's from India, whether Indian sociology has been dominated by what could be called colonialized knowledges. They use the plural, which is a signal of a certain sort. And that basically they need to kind of liberate themselves from this status of colonialized knowledges that have been imposed by colonial powers through various kinds of practices. And that that's the kind of way to think about different sociologies, the sociology of the Atlantic region or the North, and the sociology of the South. The sociology of the South has been subordinated to the sociology of the North, which has presented its knowledge as universal knowledge and thus imposed it on the South. And the South has to break away from that. That's the kind of premise. Now, I argued that sociological knowledge and social scientific knowledge should be universal, but that doesn't mean that the sociology that's developed in any one place should pretend to be universal, that it's a failure of, it's bad sociology to say that processes which we've correctly identified as operating in the North are necessarily the same as those in the South. I mean, that's just stupid, right? Of course, things vary. But if you systematically establish the character of that variation, you're doing so on the basis of universal principles. Universalism doesn't imply constants, it implies variation. And how do we understand it? So that I felt that the deformations of the sociological understandings in the South are the result of the operation of power and ideology, but not some epistemological problem. That it's not a meta-theoretical epistemological issue, that there's different kinds of knowledge, that somehow indigenous knowledge has any privileged status. And what then I would also add, I didn't say it quite this way, I see the task of sociology in many cases as demolishing folk knowledge. That is, the spontaneous indigenous knowledge in Wisconsin needs to be demolished just as it does anywhere else, because indigenous knowledge is typically mystified. It's filled with all sorts of errors. If that weren't true, you wouldn't need sociology. Because you wouldn't need the systematic production of sociological knowledge if it was the case that the culturally given indigenous knowledge, the knowledge that just comes from the daily practices of people in their cultural settings, was adequate for understanding the causal processes that govern their lives. You wouldn't need sociology then. You know, so this idea that you should privilege, quote, the indigenous knowledge of any place, and that it has some special status in general. Now, for some problems, it does, unquestionably, for some problems. That is, there are problems in which a key issue is, what do people think, really? What are the meanings that are embedded in their daily lives that affect various problems? Well, obviously, for that problem, the indigenous knowledge is privilege, because that's what you're trying to figure out. What is the indigenous, locally based folk understandings of things? And clearly you can't say the folk understandings in Wisconsin are the same as in Peru. That would be ridiculous. So you'd have to study the ones in Peru if that's the problem you're studying. But that's a whole different matter. That doesn't mean it's has privileged status as knowledge. It just has privileged status as the data for your arguments, because that's what you're studying. So that's what we were arguing about. I don't know. Somebody else. Well, you were there. No. Was anybody here? I didn't. I didn't fully. Her reply didn't seem to me she was really replying to what I was saying. She was deflecting. I mean, I don't think in a defensive mood. I think it was just hard. You know, it's hard on the spot to kind of grapple.
I think the language was kind of talking next to each other as opposed to each other in terms of what she was. The terminology that she wanted to be speaking in terms
right.
of was so different that it was hard to bring them together without having a much larger
right.
conversation.
Yeah, Sean.
Well, just to clarify, the other person would have called what you call objective sociological knowledge of causal processes. This other person would call it kind of a hegemonic ideology.
Well, I just don't know if she would... I don't know. See, I don't think she's a postmodern. A postmodernist would say it's all discourse. There is no distinction between science is just another discourse, just one among every discourse. There's no basis for privileging any discourse over any other. I don't think that's her position, because in some respects she sounded also embracing Marxian ideas. So but she has adopted a lot of the language of that stance, which then makes it kind of confusing. And I suspect it's because of the intellectual battle she's fighting in the Indian context, on the one hand, and in the International Sociological Association, of which she's a very active member. She's, has some official position within the ISA. So I suspect that's why she framed these issues the way she did. All right, well, if there's no follow-ups more from last time, we will launch. Yes, Mitch. Oh, yes. Are there, let's see, I only have one left. There should be a stash, yeah. Anybody else need an outline? Okay. All right, well, we are embarking in the next four lectures on, what I think we could reasonably call an intellectual adventure. This is, there are various bodies of work in the history of ideas which have the character of just extraordinary intellectual achievements, just fantastically beautiful theoretical structures, not all of which end up being robust. You know, sometimes you have fantastic theoretical structures that have deep flaws as well. Marx's effort to build a theory of history is an amazingly ambitious intellectual effort. I think the theory of history aspect of Marxism ends up being flawed in very critical ways, so that at this point in theoretical development, it's better to pull back from it than to defend it. I don't mean to abandon every element of it, but to defend that whole edifice. I just think it doesn't work adequately enough. But it is of sufficient intellectual power that it is definitely worth studying carefully and figuring out really what the deep logic behind the theory of history is and what precisely the attempt was. So that's what we're going to do in the next three lectures. I'm going to spend two mapping out the central arguments of Cohen's perspective. That's this lecture and Monday. And then on Wednesday, I'll present a series of criticisms of the argument. And then the following Monday, we will have one session that explores in a more limited way the question of a theory of history of capitalism rather than a general theory of history, and what aspect and how that is kind of reconstructed within Marxism. Okay, but the first the first things, I may not have gotten the sequence. I didn't really look at the syllabus to see if I've charted out exact. Doesn't matter. Definitely the next two are laying out Cohen's arguments. So the starting point for this is really to figure out carefully exactly what it even means to talk about a theory of history. What does it mean for history as such to be the, I'm just checking to be sure this is, yes, it is actually working. Okay. What does it really mean for history as such to be an object of theory? What does it mean to have the overall structure of historical development of human societies be theorizable scientifically? Now, one possible response to this question is, this is just total bullshit. History is not a legitimate, the overall structure of history is not a legitimate scientific object. That is, it can't be theorized. It's not just a failure of imagination, but the overall trajectory of history is not theorizable. There are things which might seem very close to it that are, but not history as such. So, for example, we certainly can develop good theories of specific events in history. You can develop powerful theories of the French Revolution. You could also have powerful theories of particular sequences of events or particular patterns of change. We can have a theory of the Industrial Revolution. So you could have competing social scientific accounts of why the Industrial Revolution occurred when it did, why was it centered in Britain as opposed to in Japan, what is it that blocked it in the Latin parts of Europe and had it take off in Britain. You can have all that, for sure. And you can certainly have social scientific theories that pay great attention to what could be called historical context. You can have historically specific theories. So we can talk about the nature of social movements in early modern Europe compared to the nature of social movements in the 21st century. You can talk about the historical specificity of political competition in the United States at the beginning of the 21st century in contrast to Northern Europe. So you can have contextual specificity where to fully elaborate context means to be historical, that is, to bring all the particulars of the historical context to bear. It's also the case that in non-historical research, there can still be historical variables. So for example, path-dependent arguments, which bring historical variables to bear on current problems, are perfectly reasonable theoretical things to do. If you want to explain why the keyboard on all of our laptops, or as we would have said it half a generation ago, typewriters, why the keyboards are laid out the way they are, why is it QWERTY, Q-W-E-R-T-Y at the top, you can't possibly explain that without knowing something about typewriter salesmen in the late 19th century when typewriters were first introduced. Because if you put your hands on a typewriter, you can spell out the word typewriter without having to move any fingers. And they designed the keyboard so that a typewriter salesman could place their hands on the typewriter and type out the word typewriter without having to pick up a finger. They could just place them. So they didn't really have to know how to type the word typewriter. The keyboard was also designed to slow down typing because the early keyboards, the keys tended to jam if you were too fast. So there were common letter combinations which would be much more convenient if for those combinations you didn't have to pick up your fingers. But people were too fast for it, so they had to slow down typing. Now that produces an inefficient keyboard, right? And the only way to explain it is to talk about the historical specificity of the technologies at the time typewriters were being sold in the first place, and the limitations of both the technology and the typewriter salesman. So you wouldn't get QWERTY if we spelled typewriter differently, but you still would have had an awkward keyboard. because you still needed to slow people down. So those two facts, how to spell the word typewriter and how to slow down typing, explain the basic layout. There's an alternative keyboard which has been developed in which if you learn to type on it, you can end up typing about 25 or 30% faster. Big improvement in productivity, right? But if you haven't learned to type on it, the transition costs of unlearning your touch typing from one system and learning it another are huge. I mean, it takes a very long time to get back up to the level of proficiency that you had. And that loss of typing speed for that transition is too big for people who are well trained in the other keyboard to ever want to embark on it. And that's been the obstacle to the introduction of this much more efficient keyboard. They are now available because with computing technology, you can change the assignments of any key you want to. So it's very easy to have now, without a lot of extra cost, to have these different kinds of keyboards. And there was the hope that a new generation of people would then, when they first learned to type, would learn to type on the new keyboards. The problem is most people learn to type now at a very early age on home computers that their parents use. So it's still the case that they get locked into the inefficient technology. This is just such a great story. It's why I'm spending the time on it. But it illustrates a perfectly legitimate kind of historical explanation, the role of historical phenomena in a good hardcore social science explanation. You can believe all those things are possible, but that an actual theory of history that takes the totality of human history as its object as a impossible theory. Now, Marx, however, had a different answer. He thought it was indeed possible to develop a systematic scientific theory of the causal processes that propelled human society from its earliest forms through a series of developmental stages into the present and, crucially, beyond. He thought this was possible, that you could have a law-like developmental logic to the overall course of human history. Let me explain what this really means, okay? So let's look at a number of other kinds of theoretical enterprises that are also theories of history. So there's three that I think come to mind. There's cosmology, the history of the universe. There's evolutionary biology, the history of the development of life. And there's there's embryology. There's the theory of the development of human organisms of living organisms from fertilized cells, fertilized eggs, to adult members of the species. So first, cosmology. Now, cosmology is indeed a theory of the history of the universe. It takes the overall history of the universe as its object. It's preoccupied with the first few microseconds, a lot of cosmology is concerned with the Big Bang problem and the evolution of the universe in the very first short period of time. But overall, cosmology is concerned with the development of the universe from the Big Bang to either the fiery death or the cold death, depending upon which view of the ultimate destiny of the universe you hold. And that's, in principle, a comprehensive theory of the entire history of the universe beyond the present through various stages, the hot universe, the cooling universe, and so on. The laws of physics provide the raw materials for that, and the attempts to create a coherent theory of cosmology has pushed the laws of physics dramatically. So all sorts of developments in physics are byproducts of trying to refine cosmology. Evolutionary biology, that's another theory of history. Now, evolutionary biology is very different from cosmology. Evolutionary biologists do not have a theory of the future of biological evolution. Indeed, they have no theory, a prospective theory of the history of living organisms at all. There's nothing in evolutionary biology that says once you get a single-celled organism, eventually you get neurologically complex creatures capable of studying biology. Right? There's nothing that's teleological. That is, that some end state is explained by the initial state, let alone the strong teleology, which is that the end state kind of explains the development to the end state. Evolutionary biology is entirely a retrospective theory of history. It explains fully everything that's happened and why mammals succeeded reptiles, but only why they succeeded it, given that they did succeed it. In the age of dinosaurs, 100 million years ago, if you happen to have been a evolutionary biologist who was a dinosaur or something, you would have seen these small, very minor creatures that we later called mammals. There were mammals in a small niche, but there would have been no way of predicting and no theory of that's a theory in biology that would have enabled you to predict the triumph of mammals as the most neurologically complex creatures yet seen in the universe, let alone on the planet Earth. Now, the reason for that is that the actual evolution of species depends upon a combination of biological theories and astronomy. You know, theories which have nothing to do with biology. That is, the movement of asteroids through the solar system. The movement of asteroids through the solar system, which is an unrelated theoretical problem, has nothing to do with the mechanisms of natural selection, per se. Contingently, one of them hits the Yucatan Peninsula 75, 80 million years ago, or whatever the current story is, creates a massive dust cloud which cools the Earth dramatically for a long enough period to precipitate the extinction of dinosaurs. So let's assume that that's a correct theory. That is a completely contingent event. There's nothing internal to the theory of evolution that predicts asteroids hitting the Earth at a time when mammals occupy a niche, and because they're warm-blooded are able to survive sufficiently the episode of the asteroid, that they then can populate the Earth with new species. You know, evolutionary biology doesn't predict that, and can't. So you could really make an impossibility theorem, right? It can't predict the contingent events which massively affect the course of evolution. Okay. Let's now turn to embryology. Now, embryology is very different. What a biologist can say is the following. If you have a fertilized human egg, one of two sorts of things will happen to the development of that egg. It will develop through a series of well-defined and predictable stages to a live organism that is born and will then develop through a set of predictable stages to be an adult. No stages will be skipped. No one goes from a baby to an adolescent without being a toddler. You know, every 15-year-old was at one point a toddler just learning to speak. And every decrepit 60-year-old professor was once a vibrant 25-year-old young person, right? Whatever. You get the point. One trajectory is going through a set of absolutely predictable steps where no instance of the creatures skips steps. And another trajectory is that at some point, that trajectory is terminated. It stops. Fertilized eggs don't get implanted. Implanted eggs don't survive. Babies are still born. Toddlers get hit by trucks. All sorts of things happen contingently to break the trajectory. But those are really the only two paths. You know, there's obviously this is at a fairly abstract level. There are all sorts of variations within each of these, but it's a very good and powerful first approximation to say we have two trajectories and only two. No fertilized human egg results in the birth of a chicken. Right? We know that with 100% probability. And you can't skip stages. Now that is an incredibly powerful theory. There are lots of aspects of it that are still being worked on. The whole theory of cell differentiation and how these stages get programmed, and particularly this programming of the stages of aging of the organisms once born, that's not well understood. But what is known for certain is that it is determinant by some combination of the way the genetic structure works in interaction with environmental sources of various sorts. So it's clear that it's a developmental program and that it's explainable, even if we don't have all the explanations intact. Marx attempted a theory of the history of human societies that is pretty close in analogy to a theory of the development of individual organisms. I think that's the kind of closest analogy. He wanted to develop a theory that had that kind of developmental logic, where you could chart the trajectory of stages, where there might be more than one possible trajectory. So there is this famous expression, the future of capitalism is socialism or barbarism. Well, that's a rhetorical flourish, of course, but it indicates the possibility of more than one possible trajectory, but not an indeterminate number of trajectories. There's places in Marx where it might be possible to skip a stage, some suggestions that that could happen. That's not inconsistent with still arguing that there is a determinate sequence. It's just that it's a sequence in which, depending upon certain contingent possibilities, it might be possible to jump a stage. Some human beings seem to skip adolescence and go from childhood to adulthood. You know, you see some 13-year-olds that are really incredibly mature and acting like grown-ups. So, you know, maybe there's some kind of analogy because of our socio-psychological developmental trajectory, not just our pure biological one, where you could have a similar clear sequence with possible variations that could include state skipping. Marx's theory of history is not an evolutionary theory. Now that's an important thing to note. It'll enable you to make some very good points in some theoretical debates at some point, because often people describe Marxism as having a theory of the evolution of society. That's really a misdescription. If the word evolution is being used to draw the analogy with biology. Right? So, I mean, of course, the word evolution as an ordinary language term could just mean a developmental trajectory that's well known from the start. So you could talk about the evolution of a child into an adult. That's not the normal way you would talk about those stages as an evolution. It's a development. Marx's theory is a developmental theory of the trajectory of human history, not an evolutionary theory. And again, the reason, the key to that contrast is that evolutionary theory does not have any theory whatsoever of the history of the future. It's all retrospective. It predicts the present from the past, given that we know what happened. It explains why that happened. And so you can, after the fact, show what, in fact, the determinant processes were. And it's a theory, it is then a kind of theory of history of this particular sort, because the principles you apply are universal. So the principles you apply to the evolution from, creatures living only in the sea to the first land animals to their species differentiation are the same principles you apply to evolution in the present. So the same principles, natural selection, genetic drift, contingent mutation. You know, those kinds of principles are applied universally. Group selection, perhaps, that's become more of a common explanation now. So there's all these interesting new mechanisms that are being applied, but they apply everywhere. And that's why it's a universal theory, but of the contingent evolution of trajectories. Marx's theory of history is meant to be more ambitious than that. Is that contrast clear? Any thoughts or reactions, or don't be shy, you know. You. Yeah. So developmental theory, we know the destination from the start, although there may be more than one possible destination. So the biological organism is the clearest case. We know the destination of every fertilized egg is either mature adulthood or some truncated version, some abbreviated step. And we can specify every step of the way, you know, the fertilized egg, the fibroblast, whatever it's called. I forget my elementary biology. You know, the differentiated embryo, the fetus, the baby, the toddler, the graduate student, you know, et cetera. And we can specify those steps in advance. And we know what the destination is. We know the destination of every living person is eventually a dead person. You know, that's all of our futures. Unequivocally, without exception. Welcome to the club, right? As they say, a fact of life. Now, we know that, of course, mainly because we're empirically convinced of it, having observed it so many times in history. And then we develop a theory that helps us explain why that's the case. So it's not that the theory was based from some kind of logical derivation from first principles as a kind of logical fact. It was based on a massively robust empirical observation, which then people tried to make sense of. And then science has enabled us to actually understand the causal processes, which not just result in death, but which result in stages of development. Cosmology does the same thing for the universe. So there's this interesting, you know, it's a kind of interesting thing that the two examples where we can really think of full bore theories of history from beginning to end are cosmology, from the Big Bang to the fire or ice destiny of the universe, and the fertilized egg to the adult and end-of-life organism. But can we have a theory of the history of culture, history of society, that is as ambitious as and successful as cosmology or the theory of organisms? I mean, the life of an organism. Well, Marx thought it was possible. And Marx wasn't alone. I mean, it was a kind of 19th century thing to imagine that you could have such grand theories of history. These are often referred to as teleological theories. Strictly speaking, you know, that's a kind of metaphor, because teleological means explaining something by a goal to which it realizes. We use in our everyday life teleological explanations all the time. Why did somebody do something? Well, you explain a lot of what we do by the goals we're trying to achieve. And after you've achieved the goals, you can then retrospectively see, yes, all these steps were part of the achievement of the goals. They were explained by what eventually happens. And the mechanism of that is our motivations. You know, we are intentional beings. We have the capacity to bring the future into the present through our actions, and therefore teleology is a perfectly legitimate explanation for individual behavior. It's, in fact, I would say, the kind of core explanation of human agency is something that could reasonably be called a telos that explains why you do things to get to some point in the future. The theory of history that Marx proposes is sometimes also referred to as teleological. I'm not sure that's entirely a fair characterization, because Marx never really says it's the goal of society. Sometimes there's language that has this character, but it's not really that it's the goal of society to reach communism, as it were. It's simply the dynamic of society that propels it towards communism. And that's not exactly telos, although sometimes there is language like the mission of the working class is to overthrow capitalism. Well, once you start using that kind of language, then you're certainly inviting this characterization, teleological. Usually when that's invoked, it's a criticism. You know, it's a way of just showing that the theory is metaphysical, but it involves some illegitimate kind of reasoning. So Marx wanted to do this. Now why? Why would you want such a theory? What? Let's suppose that it was possible to get it. Why would you want a theory of history? Why would we want to have a good theory of the future, of the history of the future? Yeah. So one thing is, the more we know about what the future is likely to be, even if we think of this probabilistically, just what it's likely to be like, the better we can plan our strategies in the present if we care about changing things. So that's one reason. Can you think of a, I don't want to be too Socratic here, you know, I've got an answer, you got to give me the one that I have in mind. But it's a really interesting thing to, I think this is a really interesting thing to contemplate, you know, not just in this short discussion now, but really think, why would you want such a theory? Because in general, if you're embarking on a project of theory reconstruction, of building some new theoretical structure, it's because there's some gain. I mean, I think this is a kind of pragmatist view about theory construction, but you certainly hope it to solve some problem that matters. So what does this give us? Yeah. Why something is happening needs an explanation of how the structures are operating and what their consequences are. That would not require a theory of history. That is, you wouldn't need this attempt at an overarching account of historical development in order to tackle that problem. It could be that you could embed that problem in the broader theory of history, but you don't need the theory of history to tackle that problem, I think. Yeah, all right.
Outside of this theory of history, the theory that to him is the correct theory, then it doesn't necessarily have the same importance as a theory in another context.
Well, I mean, that's a little circular in the sense that Marx needs the theory once he's got the theory, because he's got the theory in there, you know. So one thing you said, though, is connected to the motivation, although it may not be a necessary condition. But as you said, it's really important to have a clear understanding of historical variation in order to specify, for example, the conditions of struggle and contradictions of any given society. So that would be a reason why you want a comparative structural analysis of historical variation. But that doesn't itself require that you have a theory of the development of that variation. You just need a map of the variation. So consider chemistry. Chemistry has a periodic table of elements, right? Now that turns out to be an absolutely fantastic achievement in the history of science, to organize all the elements that there are that we've observed, and there are some elements in the full periodic table that we haven't observed but are thought of as logical derivations from things we've observed. And therefore, there have been cases of elements which have been postulated and only later discovered because of the logic. That's a token of how powerful the periodic table is, that it suggests the existence of elements that we haven't yet observed. Right? Now, the periodic table of elements is a structural typology of forms. And it's unbelievably powerful because everything we observe in the world is merely some form of combination of those elements. You know, that's just, you know, from the point of view of the aesthetics of theory, why theory is beautiful and not just powerful, that's just amazing that you could come up with not just a laundry list. I mean, it's not just a list of the 280 or whatever elements, but it's a typology because it's organized on a set of underlying dimensional principles. And that everything that exists is just mere forms of combination of that? Well, that's powerful and helps explain all sorts of things and helps you solve all sorts of problems, even if you have no theory whatsoever of the history of the universe that explains the trajectory of the production of those elements. Now, cosmology actually gives us some of that. We know that at the beginning it was all helium, and then hydrogen gets produced in the first nanosecond. I mean, this is already beyond my knowledge base, but sometime in the first few seconds after the Big Bang, a subset of those elements get produced by the furnace of the Big Bang itself. But it actually takes some time before the full array of elements are actually produced. Some time, you know, I don't know, 3 minutes? I have no idea. But you don't need that, right? That's interesting additional knowledge about how the world worked and came to be. But you don't, the periodic table would have had its explanatory power even if we had never discovered how the first few seconds of the universe produced the elements in a particular sequence. And they were produced in a sequence. They weren't just all produced at once. That's super interesting. You know, I find it interesting. But it's irrelevant, 100% irrelevant. Has no bearing whatsoever on the explanatory power of the typology. So we could have had a theory of historical variation where we understand, yes, feudal societies are different from capitalist societies, and the nature of the class conflicts and the forms of the state and the required ideologies to stabilize those social orders are just different from what would be true in capitalism. You could have structural comparative theories, which could have a periodic table kind of quality, because they could be forms of combination of some principled elements. And you could say, and there's no theory of how one changes into another. That's entirely like evolutionary biology or something. It just happened because of very peculiar historical contingent facts. Yeah. I think, Juhi, I think you're absolutely right about that. I think, I think if you really think about this, you can see why it's an incredibly powerful idea that you're on the side of history. Right. So,
couldn't it, just in this, using the same explanation, be something that would demotivate you, or because you think it's already going to happen?
Yeah. So it turns out that that's not true. That's just that's an empirically incorrect view about human motivation. That people are, so here's, I think, the way to frame it. Revolutionary transformations require huge sacrifices on at least a hard core of mobilized cadre and activists. They have to be prepared to make sacrifices, often extreme sacrifices, risk their lives to have these changes. You need a mobilized core of people who are really committed to this goal. Now, one of the things that it turns out increases people's motivation rather than reduces it is the belief that in the end we're going to win. Anything that makes you feel that ultimately you're very confident you're going to win, it may be two generations from now, it may be my grandchildren that will win, but you really feel these sacrifices are not in vain because they will contribute. They'll be part of history. They will contribute to this. You need to be convinced of that. Now, the character of Marx's determinism says not that you have to wait until the collapse of capitalism in order to bring about an alternative, but that the possibility of overthrowing capitalism increases with capitalist development. It becomes a more and more fragile structure, more and more challengeable, and that history is on your side. So remember, it's socialism or barbarism. There are more than one possible outcome. But the socialism one is an achievable outcome because we know in advance that the destiny of capitalism is its exhaustion. Capitalism sows the seeds of its own destruction. Capitalism has internal contradictions which progressively intensify its vulnerability over time. All of that creates tremendous motivational heart, you know, and courage, and reinforces the willingness to fight again after defeat and to scatter and then regroup. I mean, all the things that are needed for robust, long-term, stable social movements over a very long period of time, all of that is reinforced by that belief. It's a belief, of course, which is also common in religious traditions, and it's a reason why sometimes Marxism, I think not inappropriately, is characterized as having a kind of messianic, millenarian element, which is also, of course, it's not surprising in a way, it's part of the Christian views about the future history of civilization as well. Yeah. I think there are lots of ideas around at the time that had this kind of character, imagining the unfolding of some future realization of human potentials that would be a whole other stage of development. It was part of Christian theology in terms of the views of the millennium. It was reinforced by certain aspects of evolutionary biology when that became fashionable, although Marx's ideas about this developed really at the same time rather than in response to that. But I think the Juhi's point about how deeply motivational this is, and it does create this fantastic irony, you know, which is an irony that Chris tapped into when you suggested that determinism could be demobilizing, because you think that to have a theory of agency and the importance of human motivation, the last thing you'd want is for people to believe that this is the future, whether or not you participate. And it turns out, I think, that psychologically that's not how it works. That psychologically people are more worried about their activities being meaningless than their activities being necessary. Right? So lots of people join movements in which they know perfectly well that whether or not they join it or not isn't going to have any effect. But they join it because it makes life meaningful to be part of a process. You know, in the protests last March, where many people here were actively engaged, whether or not you stayed home didn't matter. I mean, there were thousands of people up there. They were occupying the building. It was going to be a robust occupation, clearly, after the first few days, whether or not any given person went. And yet, the very fact that this was making a difference, it was standing up, it was responding to the aggression of the governor, was something people wanted to be part of. They didn't want to be on the sidelines. And I think the individual calculation of does my action make a difference, which is the way rational choice theorists think about things, isn't the way people actually think about lots of their activities when they're deciding. Meaning has much more to do with it than just that narrower kind of rational calculation. I don't mean that this makes it irrational either, by the way. I think it's incorrect to say that joining a process because you want to be part of history and you feel it's meaningful shows that you're crazy, that you're acting irrationally. It just means the nature of your rationality isn't defined by the narrower question, what is my personal contribution going to be? That's a separate issue. They're both rational. That's just it's one type of rational calculation. The cost benefits of my own individual calculation, and another kind of rational action is what are the things I rationally can do to make my life meaningful and part of a process of human improvement. That's another perfectly rational way of thinking about orienting your own activities to a process. Yeah, Shippy.
I just wanted to suggest that maybe another reason why a theory of history would not instill in people kind of a fatalistic approach that we're going to get there no matter what I do, so why even bother, is that so far we've discussed that the contradiction in capitalism mean that it will eventually be in people's interest to overthrow the system of capitalism, and so in order to take that fatalistic view, you kind of have to go against your own self-interest, and you have to actively say, no, I'm not going to do what I want to do, I'm not going to do what I think is best for me, I'm going to do nothing just because it doesn't matter if I do anything anyway.
Well, but you know, what's best for, the expression, what's best for me, it's you, in most struggles, in many struggles, what's best for me is to be on the sidelines. That is, the struggle is going to succeed anyway. I will get all the benefits of the victory, but I won't have to make the sacrifices. So if what's best for me, as opposed to what's most meaningful for me, if what's best for me is the calculus, do I want to take the risks of being hurt, of being killed, of losing my job, or not? Well, in most contexts, that calculation leads to free riding. But that's only one of the many kinds of matrices within which people make their life choices. And, it's a stylized, I'm making a very stylized description, but one, I think, appropriate stylized way of thinking about this is people make choices based on meaning and people make choices based on benefit, cost benefit. Sometimes one is triumphs and sometimes the other. We all do both. You know, there's many choices we all make that are just straightforward cost-benefit choices. You decide it's just not worth the trouble. But some things are, because, you know, the costs are more than the benefits. Just one little coda here. So this is a little digression for future conversations that you have about rationality and these sorts of matters. There's a way of jiggering this rational choice problem in which everything becomes just cost and benefit, because you then just package meaning into the benefits, right? So you have meaning benefits. Well, then it's trivial. Of course you are always making cost-benefit analyses. One of the benefits is a meaningful life. And then there's just, then the rational choice calculus argument, I think, loses its interest, the explanatory interest, and I think it's a very powerful theory, and we'll be using it a lot. There's some, when we discuss class formation and class compromise, we're going to go straight into game theory and the, you know, hard-edged rational choice discussion, because I think it's useful for that. But it gets its usefulness precisely because of the narrowness of its conception of rationality, not because of its expansive conception. If you expand it, then you're just talking about human psychology and the fact that people do things for motivated reasons. And if you call every motivation the benefit, then you've reduced it to a pretty trivial claim, I think. The only thing then that's excluded from rational choice theory are things which are explained strictly by habit. You know, things that become habitual, that don't involve choice, that become just like the way you use grammar. It's not that we all speak grammatically because of a rational calculation, that the benefits of speaking grammatically are higher than the costs of not know, never, never what, who, speaking, you know, I mean, we don't not speak ungrammatically because of a calculation. It's because we're hardwired to speak grammatically once you learn a language, because it facilitates communication, and that's constantly reinforced, and it becomes automatic. It becomes extremely hard. Actually, it's extremely hard to speak ungrammatically once you've acquired a grammar. You know, you have to really work at it. Okay, enough digression. All right, we are at Roman numeral 2, page 3 out of 11 of my notes. Yeah, sure.
Sorry.
Sure, Paula. Absolutely, that's a nice trilogy. It's a very nice use of language to capture possible. So there is a shift from a fully determinist theory of trajectory to a theory of possible futures, right? In which then what we would ideally like is to have probable futures and possible but not probable futures. And then we'd like to think strategically if the ones that are possible but not probable are the most desirable, then our strategic thinking would be about what can we do now to affect the course of history towards the possible but not probable outcomes. Yeah, so that's a way of definitely of softening the deterministic character. I think it's a softening that goes against the central logic of Marx's own argument. His socialism versus barbarism, you know, I'm not sure if Marx himself said that. It's associated also with Luxembourg because she popularized it. So if any of you are more Marxiologically inclined and can find the actual quotes, I don't know if he directly said that, but that's the aphorism in any case that captures this. That's a pretty primitive set of possible futures. And the barbarism part of it was never given any specificity. It wasn't clear whether that's just an even more brutal capitalism or whether it's some alternative to capitalism. So I think that's how you could work with it. It turns out, I think, that it's easier in a way to imagine a plausible theory where there's only one really possible future than an actual theory which assigns probabilities to alternatives. You know, it becomes just very hard to even imagine how you would assign those probabilities, how you would develop any kind of credible argument that goes beyond the very near future. You know, so we can make reasonable predictions about what's likely or unlikely over the course of the next few years. If I was to be asked the question, what are the possible forms of society and what probabilities would you assign them for the year 2200? I just wouldn't have a clue how to even go about it. So I think you're right that is a nice way of thinking about an alternative. But in the end, I think even that's too hard to get much traction on. So what we're going to work on, though, is to try to really understand how you could even imagine developing a theory of a determinate trajectory. You know, what's the structure of this? And in the course of doing that, like a lot of good theoretical efforts, it helps to clarify a series of more general methodological and theoretical ideas, which have use way beyond the particular confines of this particular theoretical project. Okay, I think we should take our mid-class break. It's 4 after 11. Let's shoot for 10 after to get started. Okay. All right, so let's resume. Let's resume. So Marx has this very ambitious attempt, and it's motivated by theoretical reasons, but also by these political and ideological reasons. It would be great to have such a theory. Now, the primary purpose of the general theory of history, however, is actually to provide groundings for what could be called the special theory of capitalist history. I mean, after all, really all that matters for these motivational purposes is to know what the destiny of capitalism is. To know with more confidence than one might imagine possible, to have confidence that the overcoming of capitalism is historically possible, and even better, it's the destiny of capitalism. So what all we really need is a theory of the history of capitalism, from its origins to the present and into its future. We don't actually need an overarching theory of history. But if you can do both, it's all the better. So if you have an overarching theory of history of which the theory of capitalism is a part, and the arguments for the theory of capitalism then get a double support. They get a support because you've properly diagnosed its internal dynamics, and because those internal dynamics fit into an overall historical dynamic. Now, the fact of the matter is that Marx devoted orders of magnitude more energy to developing the specific theory of the history of capitalism than he did the overall theory of history. Historical materialism, as the name for the overall theory of history, is very underdeveloped in Marx's own work and doesn't figure directly in much of his theory of capitalist history. That is, much of his theory of capitalist history is simply an attempt at diagnosing the specific dynamics and laws of motion of capitalism that produces the trajectory of development of that particular kind of social system, without reference to broader theoretical ideas that go outside of the specificities of capitalism. This is one reason why one might even argue it's a kind of detour to even go into this general theory of history. Now, why bother? It is, after all, a burden. It's complicated. Even what I consider this brilliant book by Cohen is complicated. It's, if you've read parts of it, you know it's not bedtime reading. Although I do hope you're finding it interesting, but it's not bedtime reading. I have actually thought at various times, given the constraints in this class, I can't do everything. Maybe I should drop this. We'd have more time for discussing the state and ideology if we spent less time on this chunk. But for a variety of reasons, I continue to think it's worthwhile. I think the byproducts of studying this are worthwhile. It enables us to explore a bunch of interesting kinds of questions. It is such a grand effort in the history of thought that I think it's worth being part of everybody's menu of ideas that you've come to terms with. And I do think the weaknesses of it help to set the stage for a variety of other theoretical ideas we'll be exploring. So that's all the justification for spending the amount of time that we're doing. I've also, I think I might have mentioned this at the very first lecture, I've gone back and forth between locating this part of the discussion right up front at the beginning or sticking it at the end of the semester. The argument for sticking it at the end is because it is hard. It's easier to grapple with later because you will have more of the ingredients and ways of thinking. So it will be not quite as challenging when it's at the end. But in the end, I felt that putting it at the beginning, even if it's biting off a lot early on, still works better because it does so much stage setting for other arguments that we'll be encountering. All right. So now what I'm going to do then is turn to the general theory. That's what we're going to spend our time on mostly this lecture, the rest of this lecture and the lecture on Monday, is laying out the core arguments as Cohen reconstructs them of the general theory of history. So, classical historical materialism aspires to be a theory of the overall trajectory of history across epochs. A first step in thinking about what the structure of this theory is to figure out what are the epochs. So what, to have an overall theory of the epochal history of humanity, we need a typology of epochs and a theory of the transition from one to another. What a general theory says is that the theories of transitions from one to another have theoretical continuity across all epochs. Right, so that's what makes this a general theory. We have, if you just think of it this way, you've got epoch A, B, C, and D. Let's suppose that's all we've got. We have to theoretically distinguish A, B, C, and D. We have to have a theory of the transition from A to B, B to C, and C to D. Right? Now, if we had a completely different theory for the transition from A to B, from the transition from B to C, if those two transitions had nothing whatsoever to do with each other, they followed completely different kinds of causal processes. They weren't subsumable under any general principles. Then you really wouldn't have a general theory of history. You'd have a general description of history. You'd have a general typology of history. But then you'd have two theories. You'd have the theory of the transition from A to B and the theories of transition from B to C. But they wouldn't have anything to do with each other. Marx's argument is, as reconstructed by Cohen, is that we in fact have only four epochs. We can give them names that are a little better than A, B, C, and D. We have four epochs and three transitions. And we can generalize the theory because we can order these epochs in a sequence along some underlying principle, and we can understand the nature of the transition process in a way that has sufficient similarity across transitions as to constitute a general theory. That's the ambition here. So what are the epochs? Cohen uses a different language for describing these epochs than Marx does, but I think his move is okay for this. It's a way of trying to capture what's most crucial about the arguments and avoid certain kinds of terminological battles, which otherwise are a kind of distraction. So, his first epoch is pre-class society. That's human societies before there were class relations. Marx called that primitive communism. I think calling them pre-class societies is just fine. I mean, I think that's an appropriate way of demarcating what's distinctive about that first stage with respect to this theory, because this is a theory about how you have a sequence of stages that are differentiated by the character of their class relations. So pre-class society is a way of describing this early form. The second epoch is pre-capitalist class society. And the third epoch is capitalism. Okay, so now we've got three epochs here. The first is pre-class, the third is capitalist. What are we going to call the one in between? Now here's why Cohen calls them pre-capitalist class societies. There's a whole variety of different structures that fall into that stage, that particular epoch. There's feudal societies. There's slavery. There's tributary societies. There's what Marx, I think, inaptly called the Asiatic mode of production, which is a completely un-Marxist term. It doesn't make sense from a Marxist point of view to define a mode of production by its location. I think tributary mode of production is a better term. So there's different kinds of social structures with different kinds of class relations, all grouped in this intermediate stage between pre-class society and capitalist society. And what Cohen is saying is that the theory doesn't actually explain why you get feudalism in some places and a tributary mode of production in another. The theory isn't fine-grained enough to to explain that variation. What it does explain is why you get pre-capitalist class societies following pre-class societies, why that first transition occurs. And the theory does explain why and under what conditions the second transition occurs from pre-capitalist to capitalist. But the theory doesn't explain transitions among the pre-capitalist class societies. That will be more like evolutionary biology. It'll be completely contingent. It mattered to some pre-capitalist class societies that they were in ecological settings where large-scale irrigation projects created huge increases in productivity, capable of sustaining large state apparatuses with professional militaries. And where that happened, that acted as an obstruction to the development of capitalism for various reasons. So there's arguments why what goes on inside of the variations of pre-capitalist class societies make a difference, but there isn't a general theory. The general theory doesn't help explain any transitions among those. And that's why Cohen opts for the term pre-capitalist class society. Now, it's not that he objects to the term feudalism. Feudalism is one particular form of pre-capitalist class society, and it's the form that occurred in Europe. And it's in Europe where the transition to capitalism occurred. And that's why Marx focused it on the feudalism-capitalism transition. But the general theory, I think, is better reconstructed using pre-capitalist class society. And then finally, Cohen, the fourth stage, he calls post-capitalist non-class society. That's where the ultimate transition is to. And also avoids giving it a more positive name because the key logic of the transition is that capitalism is destroyed and a transition to a non-class form of social organization occurs. And that theoretically identifies the character of the epic better than giving it a more ideologically rich label like socialism or communism. But that also corresponds to Marx's notion of communism. Okay, so there are these four epics and three transitions. And the question then is, can we theorize, can we develop a general theory that will explain this sequence and these transitions? Now let me give you what could be called the core intuition. And the core intuition gets us pretty far. It doesn't get us quite all the way. It gets us to the third epoch. It doesn't get us to the fourth. But the core intuition does get us from the first to the third. And the core intuition would be this. This is using a metaphor that comes from Stephen Jay Gould's book, Wonderful Life. If any of you like reading, accessible, interesting science books for non-specialists. Stephen Jay Gould is a masterful writer about evolutionary biology, and he has this terrific book, A Wonderful Life, which is about the Burgess Shale discoveries in Western Canada, which were of monumental importance for understanding the early evolution of life. The metaphor comes from the Jimmy Stewart movie, It's a Wonderful Life, which a Christmas movie that gets shown every year on TV, which if you haven't seen it, it's a bit, it's a sentimental, schmaltzy movie, but it's worth seeing because it often appears as a metaphor in various kinds of discussions. Because of the particular device that's used in the movie. So that if you don't, does everybody know the movie? Or Okay, so here's the device. Here's the basic setup. Jimmy Stewart is this really kind-hearted person. He does wonderful things in his community. He's a banker. And he, you know, but he makes loans to everybody. It's a small New England town. It's a small New England town. Is he a banker or is he?
No, he's a savings and loan operator.
He's a savings and loan operator, right. He makes loans.
So much
right. He's a savings and loan operator. He really cares about people and he goes out of his way.
And he fights the bad banker.
And in the end, he fights and loses, and initially loses the bad banker. So the basic story is, his life's falling apart. He's going bankrupt. He can't meet his obligations. It's Christmas time, and he's thinking that the best thing for everybody will be for him to kill himself. And then this angel appears, who needs to save one more soul. That's his. You know, he's got this quota that he has to fill, and he basically shows Jimmy Stewart what life in his town would have been like if he had never lived. So he runs the tape, as it were, over. So he goes back and he sees how miserable so many people would have been. Right? So it gives Jimmy Stewart two views of the life of his community. One, with the contingent fact of him being present, and the other, the contingent fact of him not being present. And that convinces him that he should go on. Well, the metaphor that Stephen Jay Gould uses is to say, if we run the tape of history 1,000 times from the first single-celled organism to the present, we would end up with 1,000 different destinations in the biology case. We'd end up with 1,000 different endpoints because of the massive role of contingency at every step of the way. And the Burgess Shale example in his book is this was a period of evolution where there was tremendous diversity of body plans, of basic underlying architecture of how creatures could develop. And then there was a mass extinction event 600 million years ago. This is way before the dinosaur extinction event, which destroyed nearly all of these. And so those evolutionary pathways were simply cut off by this mass extinction, which was contingent. And if it hadn't happened, who knows what the planet would be like. Well, here's the general intuition behind the theory of history. If you had 1,000 planets like Earth in the universe with the same ecology, so they are really Earth ecologies, that is, they allow for hunting and gathering, and they have variable climates, you know, the whole bit. So you have this kind of natural environment, and you put a sentient animal in it, an animal in that environment that has our capacities. And our capacities haven't changed much in the last 100,000 years, supposedly. You know, we're evolutionarily modern humans were around about 100,000 years or so ago. But human civilization, in terms of its strong developmental logics, begins about 40, 50,000 years ago. So there's a long period where nothing much changed, and then slowly and eventually rapidly change occurs. So what Cohen argues is if you ran this tape 1,000 times, if you had had 1,000 experiments, 1,000 planets, in every one of them you'd eventually get capitalism. In 100% of the cases, you'll eventually get capitalism. If you start with primitive communism, hunting and gathering societies, and you have human beings with these kinds of capacities, where the capacities are, we're intelligent, we can solve problems, we have to transform nature in order to live. And so it's the have to transform nature in order to live is a statement about our environment. If we lived in the Garden of Eden, the history would be different. God kicks us out of the Garden of Eden. That's why we have human history. In the Garden of Eden, you don't have to transform nature in order to live. You don't have to earn your living by the sweat of your brow. That's God's punishment. Interestingly, from the point of view of Cohen's theory, which is about our intelligence and our capacity for knowledge, the reason why God kicks us out of the Garden of Eden is because we've eaten of the tree of knowledge, right? So it's because we gain intelligence that we're exiled. This is perhaps a harsh judgment. It's because we've gained a capacity for knowledge that we're kicked out of the Garden of Eden and subsequently produce human history. Because, and the Cohen argument is, if you start with those background conditions, we're rational and intelligent, and live in a world of scarcity, in the scarcity in this technical sense, that you have to expend effort in order to survive. You have to transform nature in order to survive. And we have the intelligence to do so, to solve problems. If you do that, then eventually you'll get capitalism. Now, how many years is not specified in the theory. So the fact that the time span from the first transition, that is from hunting and gathering to agrarian class structures, that first transition occurred about 10,000 years ago, somewhere in that vicinity. And it took, therefore, roughly, you know, 9,800 years to get capitalism, or 9,700 years to get capitalism, more or less. The fact that it took 10,000 years is contingent. There's no time scale. Some planets of this sort, it might take 30,000 years. Some it might take 2,000 years. But wherever you have human beings or human creatures with human intelligence and capacities and opposable thumbs, you probably need, you know, opposable thumbs, as it were. Whenever you get that, you will eventually get capitalism. And if you start in a pre-class society and you end up with capitalism, it's not going to go from pre-class to capitalism. It's going to have to go through some form of pre-capitalist class relations. That is, you're not going to go from pre-class to a investment-based society with markets and a separation of capitalist owners and investors and a labor market, labor force freed from the means of production. You're not going to go to that configuration straight from a pre-capitalist class relation, so you're going to have that intermediate step. And that's going to happen in 100% of the cases. Yeah?
Oh, I'm just thinking about, like, the case of, like, Central South Africa, when 90 years ago you had pretty much, like, a pre-class societies, like, hunter-gatherers, and then area and kind of threw them into, you know, a capitalist society,
right,
without going through, like,
right,
intermediate stages.
Right. So the claim is not that every individual community on this planet has to go through these stages. It's that on this planet there will be a time when there are every society community is pre-class society, and eventually there will be capitalism on that planet. And once there's capitalism on that planet, then everything becomes capitalist eventually. Right? So the argument that everything becomes capitalist eventually is because of the expansive character of capitalism to take over pre-capitalist societies. It's not that developmental trajectory has to occur autonomously within every community. The world becomes capitalist once any place becomes capitalist. You know, capitalism has that character that it transforms. It's also the case that the world becomes pre-capitalist class once any place does, except for isolated enclaves. And so there may be isolated places, but pre-capitalist class societies also tend to be predatory and take over neighboring societies and force them to become pre-capitalist class societies. Agrarian, you know, tributary class-based societies tend to have, not just tended, they always have, they're always militarily aggressive towards their neighbors. We'll get to that part of the argument in a moment. So that's the intuition. Now, that's a pretty powerful intuition. I find it fairly compelling that given this kind of creature with these capacities living in a world of scarcity under these environmental contexts, eventually you're going to end up with capitalism. And that's a kind of almost like a natural law claim. And that's going to happen everywhere with predictability. Now, if that intuition makes some sense, then the task is, well, why in the world should that happen? What are the mechanisms that would propel social structural transformations and innovations by these people living in these kinds of communities to cumulatively produce that kind of trajectory? Now, what the intuition, however, is really only robust for the movement between epic stage one, pre-capitalist class society, to stage three, capitalist society, with the necessity of an intermediate stage. So the intermediate stage from a theoretical point of view is derivative from the claims about the endpoints. The theory becomes much more fragile when we want to apply the logic of those first transitions to say, aha, now we have a reason to believe there's a logic to the fourth stage. Now, you can see if you could really establish the right kind of theory to explain those first two transitions, and you could defend the claim that these are universal principles that apply to every society, you could then use that as a basis for predicting the future of capitalism. You know, it would give you that the key link. The key link is that last transition. That's the one that you really care about. That's one, however, for which you have no empirical evidence. You have empirical evidence for the first two transitions. You have good descriptions of the kinds of societies that constitute the epochs within those first two transitions. You develop a theory, and if it's a successful theory, it would be a compelling, powerful theory of the history from the past to the present era that also explains in a unified way the two transitions that have occurred. And then you extrapolate the theory into the future by applying the same law-like logic to the future that you've reconstructed for the past. I think that's the move that's completely unsuccessful. And it's basically involves a lot of hand-waving. I don't think it has firm theoretical arguments. But still, I think it's worth seeing how you get to that kind of stage in the argument. All right, we're ready to move on to Roman numeral 3. Is everybody still tracking on board? You see where we're going? All right. So here's the now, from here on, I really am going to be assuming that you've at least had one pass through this material. I'm not going to reconstruct Cohen's argument in the exact step-by-step way he does. So I'm going to re-describe it for you. I'm going to distill it into certain elements. But some of what I have to say now will make a little less sense if you haven't read the work. So certainly over the weekend, before we get back to this on Monday, really try to get through the readings from Cohen. So the basic argument underlying Cohen's reconstruction revolves around a special kind of explanatory principle called functional explanation. At the heart of the way Cohen thinks we have to develop a theory of history is a specific kind of explanatory principle, particularly a way of understanding how do you explain something, which is called functional explanation. His analysis involves two interconnected functional explanations. The first is the forces of production functionally explain the relations of production. Forces explain the relations functionally. Functionally explains. So the word explain here means functionally explains. And the relations of production functionally explain the superstructures. Why do we have the kind of states we have? Because they are required by capitalism. Capitalism as a structure of relations of production functionally explains the kind of state we have. Capitalism explains the state, but how? It functionally explains it. Now, functional explanations are tricky, super interesting. You know, if you like philosophy of science and these kinds of super abstract, methodological, meta-theoretical problems, it's hard to find a more engaging one, I think, than the problem of functional explanation. Functional explanations have a kind of peculiar character because they have the character of saying that the consequence of something helps to explain its existence. Something is explained by its consequences. That seems ass backwards, right? I mean, you know, we think of causation as having a temporal structure where the causes are always antecedent to the effects. A cause explains the effects. Here's a case where the effects are explaining the cause. That is, the consequences of a structure, of a social relation, help to explain the existence of that relation. This kind of explanation is common in biology, and nobody, I think, really has any problem with it in biology. If you want to answer the question, why do birds have hollow wings? Right? So birds, the wings of birds, the bones in the wings of birds. It's not that they have hollow wings, they have hollow bones in their wings. Why are the bones of the wings of birds hollow? The answer is because these are necessary if they are to fly, because they reduce the weight of the wing. So you've got an aerodynamic problem to solve. How do you get enough lift and flexibility in wings to get these creatures off the ground? And a good solution is to make their bones hollow. The effect of hollow bones is flight, but that explains the hollow bones. That's weird. You explain the hollow bones by their consequences? Why do giraffes have long necks? Not Rudyard Kipling's explanation, but why do they have long necks? Well, the answer that evolutionary biologists say is that the long necks of giraffes enable them to eat the leaves of the acacia tree. Giraffes have long necks because a consequence of having a long neck is that they can get those leaves that nobody else eats at the top of the acacia tree. Well, in biology, these are common explanations for all sorts of things. You ask questions about why is the structure of the heart the way it is? It's because of the efficiency results of pumping blood in particular ways in our bodies. You know, you explain all sorts of things functionally. Well, the reason we can do this in biology, of course, is because we've got this very cool mechanism that explains evolution, which is there was once upon a time a giraffe with a short neck. And then there was a random event in which some baby giraffe had longer necks than its parents. And that enabled that baby giraffe to reproduce at a slightly higher rate than those baby giraffes with shorter necks, because there was some survival advantage, which means reproductive advantage, to enable those genes to be passed on. So the longer neck gene was passed on in the giraffe community, and eventually through this iterative process of mutation and natural selection, increased probabilities of survival, which means sexual reproduction, making copies of yourself, led to the longer necks. So there is an ordinary causal process which has the conventional temporal sequence. A mutation has the consequence of a longer neck. A longer neck has the consequence of better nutrition. Better nutrition has the consequence of higher reproductive survival. Higher reproductive survival has the consequence of longer necks generalizing in the population. That's ordinary sequence, cause and effect, cause and effect, cause and effect. But because of the iterated quality, in the end, it's a perfectly correct explanation to say, well, why did they end up with longer necks? Because it enables them to eat the trees, the leaves of the acacia tree. So So the temporal inversion, explaining a structure by its consequences, is the result of a natural selection process which occurs in real time to produce that temporal inversion in the explanatory. But it does. But the explanation is still properly a functional explanation. Well, Cohen argues that that's how we should explain history with functional explanations. Now, let me give you an example of a social explanation that has the same functional structure. And this, my favorite example comes in sociology, comes from Malinowski, famous early 20th century anthropologist. He has this wonderful explanation of fishing rituals in the Trobriand Islanders, among the Trobriand Islanders. And the basic explanation goes like this. You get elaborate and complicated rituals for fishing out in the open sea, but no rituals for fishing in the lagoons. So they have elaborate rituals when the islanders go out in the open sea to fish, but no rituals when they fish in the lagoons. And the explanation that he gives for this is that the rituals reduce fear. The consequence of rituals is to reduce fear. Right? Since the reduction of fear is beneficial to the community, they need to do the deep sea fishing. It's tough to do the deep sea fishing if you're scared constantly. The rituals reduce fear, so you are more successful fishing as a result. We can say that there's a functional explanation of the occurrence and persistence of rituals. And you can draw this. There's a nice way of drawing this kind of explanation. And this is a kind of general way of thinking about it. Okay? So what we have is fear. Okay? And we have rituals. And what we observe is that the claim is that fear produces rituals, and rituals reduce fear. And then we have something here called danger, which is from the deep sea fishing, right? So danger produces fear. Rituals neutralize fear. And fear produces rituals. So this is a kind of homeostatic iterative feedback system, which is fueled by an exogenous fact, the environmental condition that produces fear. One of the things you'd predict from this is that if the technology changed to make deep sea fishing less dangerous, so that there would not be this external process jacking up fear constantly, then over time the ritual should deteriorate, because rituals are costly. They involve a lot of investment of resources and time. And the need for rituals to reduce fear would be reduced, because fear is no longer being constantly fueled by this exogenous factor. And that's, in fact, what happened after Malinowski in the Trobriand Islands, as the technologies of fishing changed, when you had motorboats rather than outrigger canoes or whatever. I mean, I don't have detailed knowledge of the exact process. The external pressures reduced, and the rituals became simpler. Now, the rituals didn't disappear, because rituals may end up serving a variety of purposes. Another common anthropological argument is that rituals help to build community solidarity. They're just serving the expressive function of making us feel that we're all one people sharing a common fate. And that the ritual function, the functions of ritual for solidarity remain, even if the functions of ritual for fishing danger don't. But because the path-dependent history of these rituals comes from fishing, the meaning content of those rituals is embedded in those traditions, and therefore you can't just change them to some other kind of ritual, a solidarity ritual, without undercutting their solidarity effects. Their solidarity effects come from being part of a long history of such rituals. That's the basic structure of a functional explanation in social science. The basic idea is there's some source of tension, there's some process which is causing a problem, there's some kind of structure which reduces that problem. So you have a problem and you have a social structure. This is the social structure, which counteracts the problem. And you get an equilibrium because the problem triggers the production of the social structure. Now, this part of the equation, how does fear generate rituals? What's the process by which fear generates rituals? There's all sorts of possible mechanisms that you can place in here. You can have, in some contexts, the mechanism can be thought of as just kind of random, like, as in biology, almost like mutations, random. One way of explaining profit-maximizing strategies by capitalist firms is to say capitalists are idiots. They have no clue what maximizes profits. They just randomly pick strategies. But those firms which pick the right strategies survive, and those which don't, don't. So in the end, you get profit-maximizing structures. The fear of, you know, going out of business, and the population of firms with profit-maximizing structures are the ones that survive. So there, it's really Darwinian. Competition in the market has a quasi-Darwinian character with respect to the institutions of capitalism, because firms are competing with each other for survival. In communities, with the case of rituals, there are instances where you can say, okay, we observe these communities after thousands of years, and all the ones that didn't survive, we don't observe. There are lots and lots of communities and cultural groups which disappear. And one reason why they disappear is because they didn't produce enough solidarity, and they broke apart into feuding rivalries, and they didn't go out to the deep sea to get the fish they needed, etc. And those communities which survive are the ones that, in fact, through trial and error, just manage to end up with the kinds of institutions which enable them to survive and thrive. So you can sometimes have Darwinian-type explanations for cultural forms as well. More often, I think, it's that there are geniuses in these communities. There are shamans. There are people who are wise and who know intuitively, not because they've read Malinowski, but they know that there is tremendous fear and that they have a kind of creative, inspirational way of quelling fear. And they elaborate and innovate in ritual life because it works. So there is a kind of intentionality to the creation of the solutions, as opposed to just random mutation. Yeah. So, functional explanations are only one kind of explanation. There are also what are called intentional explanations. That is, people act consciously to solve a problem and create the necessary institution to do so because they've thought a lot about it and have figured out what the best way to do something is. That's an what would be called an intentional explanation. Why do we have the state policy we have? Because it was designed by, on purpose, to solve these problems. We'll be contrasting functional explanations and intentional explanations in a number of times in this course. I think that actual policies come out and structures and institutions evolve or emerge or develop through a combination of functional and intentional explanation, that both are operating. The system, once you get large societies that are complicated and that reproduce themselves over time, and in which the issue is not really their survival, but how well they function, then the functional mechanisms per se, the pure functional mechanisms, are likely to be a lot weaker than the intentional ones. And the result of the intentional policies and structures can often be pretty bad functioning, right? Because people can make mistakes, or they can design policies that serve their interests but harm the system, which is a common enough, one of the common sources of failure. But we'll be talking about that kind of problem, the relationship between functional explanation and intentional one, in a variety of times. Here I just want to get the logic of a functional explanation as clear, since it's at the core of what Cohen talks about. And it's 12 o'clock, and I know some people are already pressed for time. So we will start with item 4 under Roman numeral 3 on Monday. Yeah, sure. Yeah. 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 Yeah.